We're holding on page Huf Dalet in Yoma, about the middle of the page. We're in the middle of that. They had asked Rabbi Eliezer a bunch of questions. The first couple of them, even though they're out of order here in Ein Yaakov, the first couple of them had to do with the Sari La'Azazel, which is why the Gemara brought them in over here. And then they asked him a number of other questions, and all of them he didn't answer straight out, as the Gemara is going to explain now. We talked about it yesterday, but the Gemara is going to give the reason in a minute why he didn't give the answer straight out. Page Chof Dalet in Yoma, about the middle of the page. So the next question you have, there's a whole section in parenthesis over there. It's at the end of the parenthesis. So the next question they asked him, Mamzer Mahu Livash, would a Mamzer be able to Yashin from his father? So instead of answering them straight out, Omalahem Mahu Liyabim, well, would a Mamzer be able to do Yibum? The answer now again, so in effect, he's saying, Rashi's saying again, instead of giving them a straight answer, he's telling them, why don't you instead ask whether he can do Yibum? Marsha says, this is also like the other ones. Marsha explained, we learned yesterday, that each one of them he is giving an answer, just beremez, because as the Gemara says, he doesn't want to tell them straight out because he didn't hear from his Rebbe, but he's giving them a hint. Same way as indeed a Mamzer is zoikik liyibum, meaning that suppose that so Reuven dies childless and he has a brother Shimon who's a mamzer. The halacha is that the halacha is Reuven's wife requires chalitza or yibum. Okay, you can talk about maybe the mamzer can't marry her because there's a lav involved. But nevertheless, she'd need chalitza from him. We don't say that he's a mamzer and therefore he's out of the picture because he's for a Jewish boy. So the same way then, Rebbe Eliezer is hinting to them, yes, he has every right to Yashin as well. So by definition, but there's different definitions in the Gemara of what a mamzer is. The halacha is that a mamzer is from chayvik krisis or missus bastin. Anytime with a relationship, or it could be descended from such a person. So anytime there's a relationship between a man and a woman where there's an isur koris or missus bastin, so it can be an eshesish, it can be any of 20 or so close relatives, etc., then the child from that would be a mamzer, and then in addition, as the Gemara tells us in Kiddushin, the child of a mamzer, whichever parent is a mamzer, the child of a mamzer themselves is a mamzer.
This guy's the new brother.
Right. Well, so you could have a very simple case. You could have a case where their father Yaakov. You could have a case where their father Yaakov had a wife, and then he also, and then in addition, he also had relations with an Ashes Ish or someone, and had a child with her. So the two boys have the same father. They're involved as far as Yibum, but one's a mamzer and one's not. So instead of giving a straight out answer, Rabbi Eliezer says mahu lirach mahu liyabim. In other words, as Marsha says, he's hinting to them the same way as yes, he is involved in the matter of yibum. Maybe he can't do yibum because there's an iser for a mamzer to marry a regular bas yisrael. Fine, if she's a geyoris, then he could do. If she herself is a geyoris, then let's say then they could do yibum. But otherwise, at least he has to do chalitza. The same way, yes, he can legitimately yashin. He is actually considered his father's son in halacha. Unlike, by the way. Practically speaking, Ashkenazim don't do Yibum. That's a whole other matter. We don't do Yibum nowadays because you have the whole inyan that it has to be done purely l'shem shemayim, and if not, then it's pegeya be'erva, the opinion of Abba Shol and Yevamos, and we Ashkenazim follow that opinion. Sfaradim lav davka. But so nowadays in practice, Yibum is almost never done anyway. But we're talking the ikar adin though. Yeah. Anyway, the point is, as opposed to now, if the father had relations with a goiter, with a shivcha, then it would be different than the child. Then, as you know, the child follows the mother, and then the child wouldn't be considered a yid, and he wouldn't be considered his brother's brother. But since here he's a yid, he's a full fledged yid. He's just a mamzer. Then yeah.
Was it the kind of
So for a mamzer, the Gemara tells, the Mishnah tells us in Kiddushin, Reb Tarfon says over there that a mamzer can marry a shivcha and can have relations with a shivcha, and then the children are avodim. Then he can free the avodim, and then they're no longer mamzer. Then they're no longer mamzerim because the chain has been broken. You have in the Mishnah over there, Rabbi Eliezer, I think, disagrees with that and says the child will be an eved mamzer. So you haven't gained anything. The halacha is that does tackle work. So at least for a male mamzer, there is a way out of things. In modern times, I don't know. I mean, nowadays we don't have shvachas. Nowadays we don't have a shivcha knanis. So I don't know. There was actually a novel that a privately published novel that I read recently, where a Yiddish novel where the plot of it turns on this point. There's a guy who finds out that he has reason to believe that he's a mamzer. So he hatches a whole plan to get a shivcha knanis, et cetera, et cetera. It's a whole fascinating book. But anyway, yeah. So the next question they asked him, Mahu losudas beisa, is a person allowed to plaster his house? The point being, after the Churban, maybe it's not appropriate to do. The Gemara actually talks about this in Baba Basra, that after the Churban, there are different things that we don't do as a matter of such simcha as we did before. And again, instead of answering them straight out, Omalahem, he answers them, Mahu losudas kivroi, you have to ask, should a person plaster his kaver? Now, there is a concept in halacha that a kaver does have to be marked with plaster so that people stay away from it and don't become tomei accidentally. But there, you're not plastering it for beauty, or you're plastering it for a practical purpose. So again, he's using that as like a way of fobbing them off. Marsha doesn't explain it over here, but he refers to what he says in Baba Basra on this, where the Gemara explains there's actually a machlokas on that question. Is a person taka allowed to plaster his house nowadays after the Churban? Or is he, and in that case, he should leave a zecho l'churban, he should leave one amma space unplastered, or is he b'chlal not allowed to? So Rabbi Eliezer didn't want to take a side in that machlokas, so therefore he's saying, in effect, look, if a person has a kaver, but a person is not going to plaster the kaver while he's alive, he may prepare himself a kaver while he's alive, but he's not going to plaster it then. Only after he passes away and they bury him, then they'll plaster it because they have to mark it off for Tumah. So the same way he's hinting to them, there's something about plastering that shouldn't be done. Whether it means don't plaster at all, or whether it means do it but leave the amah al amah as a zeichel churban, I'm not taking sides in that. Anyway, the point is, loy mikplashi fluga midvarim. With all of these questions, it's not just that he wanted to distract them and fob them off with words. Ella shalosh omer davar shalosh shomer piramba. Rabbi Eliezer never wanted to say anything that he hadn't explicitly heard from his rebbe, which we talked about yesterday. A number of approaches why he would do that. He didn't things that don't depend on svara, things that come with Kabbalah. He didn't want to quote. He didn't want to quote unless his rebbe had said it explicitly. He didn't want to infer one thing from another. Sfasemis gives another example that he would only another answer that he would only do this while his rebbe was alive. So according to that, then all these questions would have been while his rebbe, Rabbi Yechonon Zakkai, or whoever else was his rebbe, was alive, and there are various other approaches. So if he heard directly from his rebbe, he would give the answer, but otherwise he would not. So that's according to the Sfasemis. Yeah, we're talking only when his rebbe was alive. There are a number of other different explanations why he would act this way. Okay. We said in the mission of a chedesh osuloy chola, we said that when the guy is going out, the sar lazozol, they made a ramp or a causeway for him. And the mission said because of the bavliyim, because the bavliyim would grab onto his hair, meaning either the person's hair or the goat's hair, and they would be yelling at him, Torovatse, take it and get out of here. Don't delay any longer. So therefore, they had to build this causeway so they can't reach it. So who are these bavliyim? Omer Rabba Baba Chana, loy bavliyim hoyu ele Alexandriyim hoyu. These people were not actually from Babel, they were from Alexandria in Egypt. Because they hate the Bavliyim, therefore they called these people Bavliyim as a derogatory name. Now, who is it that hated the Bavliyim? Rashi explains that the people of Eretz Yisrael hated the Bavliyim, and therefore they would call any Kalei Rosh, any people who act in a disrespectful way like that, they would call them Bavliyim. The same way as nowadays you'll have people use such things that people will take a name from one place and apply it to people even who are not from that place but act in a certain way. Yeah. So now Rashi doesn't explain why the people of Eretz Yisrael didn't like the Bavliyim, but we did learn earlier in the Masechta that actually we had Rish Lakish, who was a native Eretz Yisraelian. He one time says to Rabba Baba Chana or Zairi, we had different possibilities over there. He says that I and maybe even Hashem hate you Bavliyim because you should have come up back when they were building the second Beis Hamikdash. You should have all left Babel and come to Eretz Yisrael, and it's your fault that the second Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. So therefore, there's an explanation that Rabba Rashi is referring to that. So therefore, the Bnei Eretz Yisrael blame the Bavliim for that, even hundreds of years later. And therefore, so now, of course, this is talking about during the time of the Second Beis Hamikdash, but still, that they blame the Bavliim that we didn't have the Gola Mitzvah Shlema at the time. Meanwhile, we learned in that Gemara of Yechanan and said there was a different reason for it. The Shechina didn't rest in the Beis Hamikdash, in the Second Beis Hamikdash as much as the first, because it was built under the direction of Kodesh, who was from Yefes. We had that whole thing earlier in the Masechta. Anyway, the point... Because they didn't come up. So Rav Shlokish had argued based on Pesukim in Shir HaShirim, if all the Jewish people had come up to build the second Beis HaMikdash, then there would have been a Gula Mitzvah Shlema, and there wouldn't have had to be a Golus afterwards, and therefore he's blaming the Bavliim for that. So Rashi may mean something similar over here. So Tanya, we learn in a Braisa. Rav Yehuda Oymer, like Bavliim Hoyu, al Alexandriim Hoyu, Rav Yehuda says the same thing. So Rabbi Yossi says, may your mind be at ease because you put my mind at ease. So Rashi says, because Rabbi Yossi's family was from Bavel, so he didn't like the idea. The Mishnah is telling us these wild people are from Bavel. Now that he heard from Rabbi Yehuda that they were actually from Alexandria, then he felt a lot better. So it's not a slur on my ancestors. There's actually, Tosfos mentions, there's actually a Mishnah in, there's a Mishnah in Menachos that mentions these Bavliim and in another context as well, also in connection with Yom Kippur, actually, and also mentions their wild ways. And there you actually have the same discussion between Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda, but the other way around. There it's Rabbi Yossi says that they were Alexandrian, and Rabbi Yehuda says, Tanuach Daita, Shechinach Deis Daiti. Anyway, what it says in Menachos over there is like this. Among all the korbanos that were brought on Yom Kippur, most of them were not eaten because either they were oilos, which are burnt completely, or they were chatois, where the blood is brought into the heichal, and those also are taken out of Yerushalayim and burnt. There's one korban of Yom Kippur that's to be eaten, namely there's a regular sorer lachatos, just like on every Yom Tov, you have a par or two parim, seven elim, one or two elim, seven kvasim, and then you have a sorer lachatos. And that sir is a regular chatas that has to be eaten. So when Yom Kippur comes out on a weekday or on Shabbos, fine. Obviously, they can't cook it and eat it that day because it's Yom Kippur, but fine. They have that night to do it. A chatas can be eaten until chatzos. So then they can cook it on Motzi Yom Kippur, and the Kohenim have a few hours to eat it. What happens, the Mishnah describes, what happens if Yom Kippur comes out on Friday? Which nowadays we don't have that clear. Sloya du Rosh, and the result is Yom Kippur can't be on Friday. And then, and a number of the Rishonim learn that even in the time of the Beis Hamikdash, they would make an effort also to try and avoid Yom Kippur coming out on Friday. But if it happened that it did, then what do? You can't cook it on Friday, which is Yom Kippur. You can't do it that night because it's Friday night already. Nevertheless, so on the face of it, the korban's not going to be eaten. It's going to have to end up being burnt, like Noiser. However, the Mishnah says over there that the Bavliim would eat it raw. So now the Gemara mentions the same thing. They were actually Alexandrian, but again, they're acting in this wild way, eating raw meat. So therefore, they called them Bavliim as a derogatory thing. With all of that said, and again, you have the same thing between Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda over there, though there it's the other way around. Rabbi Yehuda, there it's Rabbi Yossi says they were Alexandrian, and Rabbi Yehuda says Tonuach Daitcha. The Sefer Dodos HaRishonim on Jewish history actually has a very interesting explanation of what's going on over here. I mean, what are the Chachamim into calling people derogatory names? Just, you know, what? So he explains like this. There was a group, we find in Josephus's histories, there was a period during the time when Urdus ruled over Eretz Yisrael, so 100 or so, you see, he began ruling 103 years before the Churban and ruled for around 40 years. There was a period during his time, there was an area in Eber HaYarden that was infested with robbers. Yeah, it's a problem because he rules over that area, and what's he going to do about it? So he found out there's a family of very tough guys, a group of very tough guys from Babel, Jews. So he convinced them to move to that area and deal with the bandits. And they did. So they settled over there. He gave them a plot of land over there, and they settled in over there. So they were Babel. I mean, yeah, they were these wild types. If they were the kinds who can deal with these robbers, they're obviously not people who, they're not bench kvetchers in the Beis Medrash after all. Well, some of them eventually moved to different places. Some of them wound up moving to Alexandria in Egypt as well. They or their descendants or whatever. Now the Jews in Alexandria were they thought of themselves as very high class, like worthy Alexandrians, and everybody else who comes in over here, anybody who moves in afterwards is like a usurper, is like an interloper or something, like somebody who doesn't really belong over here. So when we say in our Gemara that mitoch shesonim asabavli and gerdus shesonim explains doesn't mean the people of Eretz Yisrael hated the Bavlim. It means the Alexandrians, the Jews who lived there for generations in Alexandria, they hated these upstarts who came there and settled in Alexandria and are now thinking of themselves as Alexandrian citizens, and therefore they continue to call them Bavlim as if to say, you don't really belong over here, you belong in Bavel where your ancestors originally came from. So now some of these people were there in Eretz Yisrael and they would be the ones, so then the Mishnah is calling them Bavlim because that's where their ancestors were from. On the other hand, the Gemara is explaining they're Alexandrian because more recently they had lived in Alexandria in Egypt. And then when Rabbi Yossi says, or Rabbi Yehuda says, in Menachas Tanuach Dait Chashay Nach Des Daiti, is because he's saying, look, the Kehillah in Bavel is so important. It's a major center of Torah. How can we be calling these people by such a derogatory name? And he tells him, you should know, the fact is they were from Bavel, but they settled in Alexandria, and therefore that's why they're called that. And that made him feel a lot better. But he points out the fact is in both things, you do see, even though on the one hand, they're acting in a very vulgar way. On the other hand, they're doing it to a certain extent. They're acting in their own way, l'shem shamayim. They're telling the guy, get out of here with the Sari La'azazel and get rid of the Averis of the Jewish people as fast as possible. And over there, they're saying, how can we allow a korban of Hashem to become noiser, even if it means we have to eat it raw? Fine, we'll do that. Abi, the korban shouldn't go to waste. See? Okay. So we said, they said in the Mishnah, Toro Vatsay, they would tell him, take it and get out of here. Tana, so we learn in a Braisa, they would tell him, Mash Shohit Sfira Dain, what are you keeping this goat around here for any longer? V'choyve Dora Sagin, when the sins of the generation are so numerous. And Marsha says, what they're saying is like this. We know the famous concept that you should always consider that the world is chetzi chayev v'chetzi zakai, and the person himself is chetzi chayev v'chetzi zakai. And you have the famous line that the Rambam says, Osa Mitzvah Achas, which they have quoted hundreds of times, that also mitzvah achas, that you've turned the whole world lakapsulus. So therefore they're saying, get this thing with all the averas it's carrying out of here as fast as possible. What if somebody else does one more avera and then we're overbalanced to the side of chayv?
That feels so funny. The guy with the gold knows what his job is. He wants to go.
I know, but I guess, yeah, these Vilda people, I guess they would grab a hold and they would be shoving him along and whatever. So therefore they had to build this bridge to keep him away from them. Yeah. Okay. The Mishnah continues, Miyakira Yerushalayim, some of the important people of Yerushalayim, Hoyu Malavin Osead Sukkah Horeshona. They would accompany the guy with the Sari La'azazel till the first Sukkah. What Sukkahs? Esther Sukkahs Yerushalayim Vad Sukkah. They set up, before Yom Kippur, they set up 10 Sukkahs from Yerushalayim till the cliff. Sukkah means a cliff. So there's a cliff that he's going to go to throw the Sari La'azazel down. The distance, as the Gemara explains, that according to the Tana of our Mishnah, the distance is 12 mil. So every mil, every 2,000 amos, they built a sukkah. And some people would stay in that sukkah over Yom Kippur. So each one was a Trum Shabbos from the next one. So therefore, some people from Yerushalayim could walk with him till the first one. Then they would turn back and head back to Yerushalayim, and he would continue on. He's able to go because it's a mitzvah. He has to go bring it, so he's going to have to go outside the Trum. You have a machloikus whether Trumin are deraisa or derabon. Even the Rebbe Akiva holds that a Trum of 2,000 amos is deraisa. But even according to him, fine, here the Torah tells him to take it to Azazel, so therefore he has to do that. According to all the other Tanoim, Trumin are derabonon, although the Rambam learns that even according to them, a Trum of 12 mil is deraisa. Well, very well. He's only walking 12 mil, so he's not being over on any Tchum Daraisa. Maximum, he's being over on a Tchum Darabanan. And of course, you know, since the Torah says that he has to do it, then he has to do it. Anyway, so there were 10 sukkahs, Tishim Ris. The distance that he has to walk with the goat is 90 Ris, of which a Ris is Shivo Mechzel Chol Mil. There are 7.5 Ris per mil. So since a mil is 2,000 amos, it comes out that a Ris is 266 and two-thirds amos. So figuring it out, 12 mil times 7.5 ris per mil comes out to 90 ris. Tosfos actually mentions elsewhere that bringing from the Oruch that maybe the name of the measurement is not ris but rather rus with a vav, which therefore is the gematria 266, which is the number of amos in it. Rashi, by the way, mentions over here that there's a piyut by Rabbi Elazar Akaler that gives a different figure for a ris. From Rabbi Elazar's piyut, it comes out that a ris is only 180. Is only 180 amos. So Rashi wonders how that fits with our Gemara over here. But anyway, our Gemara makes it clear, our Mishnah makes it clear that a ris is 266 and two-thirds amos, and 90 times that is the distance, how much he has to walk. Where does such a measurement come from? Yossel Keller, who used to live here in Crown Heights, now he lives in Florida, once told me an interesting idea. He says, you have to imagine, you know, like this, we have a measurement of an amma, which is based on the length of a forearm. Now you have to imagine, you know, think of in the American and English system of measurement, you also have a foot. And a foot is approximately 2/3 the length of a forearm. Now, you have different opinions in halacha how long an amma is, but we can maybe assume that they had a measurement that would correspond to a foot, that would be 2/3 of an amma. Well, then, if you work it out that way, it comes out that the length of a wrist comes out to a nice round 400 of those units. So maybe, in other words, besides thinking of a mil as 2,000 amma, you can instead think of it as 3,000 of those units, 3,000 of what would have been the equivalent of their foot. And therefore, a wrist comes out to 400 of those units, which is a nice round number. I saw somebody wants to suggest, why on earth does the Mishnah have to tell us in terms of wrist? Just tell us 7.5 mil and have done with it. And so somebody wants to explain that maybe a mil is used primarily when you're talking about traveling on roads where you have mile markers every so often. When you're talking about wandering through the desert or whatever, where there are no mile markers, then instead it's going to use a figure in terms of wrist. Anyway. Al kol sukkah v'sukkah omim lai harei mazin v'harei mayim. Every sukkah that the guy comes to, they would offer him food and water. Now, the Gemara is going to explain that he never actually needed it, but this way it was meant psychologically. If he knows that it's available, then it'll make him feel much better. But in case he doesn't have the strength to go on, and we've shown him to discuss how hungry does he have to be, then he would be entitled to break his fast in order, because again, he has to complete his mission. He has to bring the surah to Azazel, and whatever it takes to get him there is going to be done. Anyway, Umalabin Oisim is sukkah to sukkah, and the people would accompany him from each sukkah to the next. So here you have the Akira Yerushalayim are accompanying him to the first sukkah. Then they would leave. Then the people, some of the people in the first sukkah, after they offer him food and water, whether he needs or not, then they would accompany him till the second sukkah and so forth. Chutz me'achon shebehem, with the exception of the people in the last sukkah, she'enim agia imen latzuk, they would not go with him all the way to the cliff. Ela omen merochik v'royas ma'isav. That guy would stand from a distance and watch what he's doing. You want to have somebody watch to make sure that he does the job correctly. But they didn't walk all the way to the cliff because it would be too far. The last sukkah, since we're saying there were 10 sukkahs, and according to the Tana of our Mishnah, it was 12 mil. It means the last sukkah was 2 mil, 4,000 amos away from the cliff. So therefore, they can only walk 2,000 amos, and then they stand 2,000 amos away and watch what he's doing. Why didn't they build another sukkah, Marsha points out, is because the point is, only he is supposed to be going to the cliff. You don't want anybody. It's supposed to be that only he goes there. The Gemara actually discusses that point, what exactly, when the Pasuk calls the place Eretz Gzeira. So some of the Mefoshim explain that actually one of the meanings of Eretz Gzeira, it has to be a land where he's completely cut off from anyone else. Meaning, if it was possible for anybody to walk there, then he wouldn't be all alone, and then he wouldn't be Yotze the Mitzvah. So therefore, they would have to build it, the last sukkah, enough of a distance away that they can't actually go with him all the way there. With that said, Marsha points out, the Gemara brings a few that we're going to learn, and the Gemara a few different opinions, how many sukkahs there were and how far the distance was. So according to some of those opinions, yes, people could walk with him all the way to the cliff. And according to them, Eretz Gzeira does not mean that he has to be completely cut off from them. Anyway. So what did this guy with the Sir Lazozel do? He would take the strip of red wool and divide it in two. Most of the Mefoshim explain that this is the same strip that he took with him from Yerushalayim. He would put it around the goat earlier after the girdle had been made between the goats. Then the Kohen Gadol would put it on the goat's horns, and now he's carrying it over there on the goat. There's an opinion that instead it was a piece that was put there that somebody had gone there before Yom Kippur and left it over there by the cliff. Anyway, he divides it in half. Chetzia kosher basela, half of it is tied to a rock, the chetzia kosher ben shnei karnav, and the other half is tied between the animal's horns. The Gemara explains, by the way, the reason why they did that. We're going to see in the Gemara on Amud Beis why they did that. Why didn't they just tie it completely to the rock or completely leave it between the horns? We'll see. Anyway. Then he takes the goat. Once he climbs up to the top of the cliff over there, he pushes it down backward, and the goat rolls backwards and starts falling down. It wouldn't even reach the middle of the mountain before it had been torn apart into limbs. We learned yesterday they asked Rabbi Eliezer what happens if it actually survives the fall, and he, instead of answering straight out, he said, "Ken Yov de Kol Evach Hashem," which Marsha said he was meant to. He meant to hint to them with that. It's impossible. It's never going to happen. The Chum actually say that if it does somehow survive the fall, then yes, he does have to go down there and kill it with his bare hands. Because one way or the other, it has to be one way or the other, it has to be killed. But in general, we're saying that just the fall down this jagged cliff would tear it apart into pieces. When we say it in the Seder Havoda on Yom Kippur, we say the guy would say Kachi Mocha Avonis Amcha Beis Yisrael. This is how all the Avedis of the Jewish people should be wiped out. Anyway. Then he comes back from the cliff and waits there in the last sukkah until it gets dark. Now, Rashi points out, when you get down to it, he has gone outside the tchum. Again, like we just talked about, he's gone far beyond. Everybody agrees that there is a tchum of 2,000 amas, just a machlokas, whether it's daraisa or derabanan. He's definitely gone far beyond that. Now, you have a halacha that says, but usually if a person goes out of the tchum on Shabbos, usually he's limited to a radius of 4 amas. However, if he went out birushus, if he went out under circumstances where the chachamim give him permission to go, for example, for the kuach nefesh or edim who are coming to testify about Rosh Chodesh or whatever, then the chachamim grant them 2,000 amas. But still, 2,000 is not 4,000. How is he able to walk all the way to the last sukkah, which is 4,000 amas? So Rashi explains because the chachamim gave him a special heter. Look, he's fasting, he's weak, he's going to be afraid to be out there in the desert all by himself until it gets dark, until Yom Kippur is over. So therefore, they gave him a heter to at least go back to the last sukkah and then settle in over there. Again, according to the opinions in the Gemara, that there were more sukkahs closer to the cliff, then you don't need that. Then the last sukkah may have been close to the cliff, and he doesn't have very far to walk at all. Anyway, continues the Mishnah. At what point during this whole procedure does he and his clothes become tameh? The Torah tells us, "Vam shaleach asasur la'azazel." The one who takes the goat to Azazel, he yichabes godav. He has to put his clothing in the mitzvah, meaning that he himself becomes an avat truma and his clothes become a rishon latruma, gzeiras hakosur. That taking the sur la'azazel causes that. So, what point in the taking of the sur causes him to become tameh? So Mishiyotza chutz l'chom is Yerushalayim, as soon as he leaves the walls of Yerushalayim, Reb Shimon Omer m'shas t'chiyosu l'tzuk. Reb Shimon says no, only when he pushes the cliff, only when he pushes the goat off the cliff, then he becomes tamei. No, because he's not going to be matame. He'll be matame anybody he touches, fine. But so they'll have to be careful not to touch him, fine. But he's not a zog. He won't be matame any chair that he sits on or anything. No, trumas oil is only for a tamei mess. So no, yeah. Okay, so the Gemara says Tanan Rabban Esav Sukkos Ushneim Osam Milin Hoyu Divrei Reb Meir. Reb Meir, who was the Tano of our Mishnah, the Stam Mishnah, and Reb Meir holds that there were 10 sukkahs and it was a distance of 12 mil. So again, you had the first sukkah 1 mil from Yerushalayim, the second sukkah 2 mil away, 3, etc., until the 10th sukkah is 10 mil away from Yerushalayim, and then you have another 2 mil, another 4,000 amos from there until the cliff. And like we said, the people in the last sukkah are able to walk another 2,000 amos towards the cliff to watch him from a distance, but they can't go any further than that. Rabbi Yehuda, imitatia sukkahs v'asara milin. Rabbi Yehuda says there were 9 sukkahs and it was only 10 milin. So according to him, the last sukkah was 1 mil away from the cliff. And in principle, the people could even walk all the way to the cliff. Tosfos actually brings a girsa that there were 10 sukkahs and 10 milin, according to Rabbi Yehuda, and Tosfos wonders, why would that be? Why would there be a necessity of having a sukkah right there by the cliff? Okay. Rabbi Yossi, I'm a chomish sukkahs v'asara milin hoyu. Rabbi Yossi says, actually, it was 10 mil, like Rabbi Yehuda says, but they didn't need 9 or 10 sukkahs, they only needed 5, v'kol an ayde eruv, because they could make an eruv chatzeres, an eruv tchumin, from one to the other. So the people in the first sukkah, for example, could be 2 mil away from Yerushalayim. So fine, they can make an eruv tchumin. They can be living in Yerushalayim, make an eruv tchumin 2,000 amos out from Yerushalayim, and then that moves over their tchum. So now on Yom Kippur, they're able to walk 2,000 amos to where they put down their food for the eruv, and another 2,000 amos to the first sukkah. Similar to the people in the next sukkah, some people in that sukkah can have been staying there the whole Yom Kippur. They can also make an Eruv Tchumen, again, which will allow them to walk 4,000 amos till the next sukkah and so forth. So that way, people can still accompany him from one sukkah to the next by means of making an Eruv Tchumen. But Amar Rav Yosi, Sochli Elazar Bni. So Rav Yosi says, actually, my son Elazar, Rav Elazar Rav Yosi, pointed out, Ima Yude Eruv, if once you're already bringing in that you can make an Eruv Tumen, Yecholi Lassas Afilu Shtei Sukkos Vasarim Milin, then really you could get away with only two Sukkos and it would cover the entire 10 mil. Because what you could do is the first Sukkah could be 4 mil away from Yerushalayim. You'd have some people from Yerushalayim would make an Eruv Tchumen 1 mil away, 2,000 amas, and then they can walk 2 mil out of Yerushalayim in return. Then, meanwhile, you'd have the people in that sukkah can make an Eruv Tchumen in the direction of Yerushalayim, 2,000 amas away from the sukkah. Therefore, they can walk 4,000 amas in the direction of Yerushalayim and meet them halfway. So now he's escorted first by people from Yerushalayim and then by people coming from the first sukkah, and that covers the first 4 mil. And the same thing the second one. You can have some people in the first sukkah can make an Eruv Tchumen in the opposite direction, in the direction of the cliff, and they can walk with him 4,000 amas. And people from the second sukkah, which is eight mil out, can make an Eruv Tchumen, and they can walk out 4 mil to meet him. So in short, you could cover the entire 10 mil with only two sukkahs, says Rav Elazar. The fact is, Tosfos Yeshayahu says, he's not really saying that as a serious argument, because how are they going to synchronize it? They're not going to know, they're not going to be able to know to exactly when the people are coming from Yerushalayim with him and exactly when the people are coming from the next sukkah and so forth, and they'd be waiting around a while. So it's not really a serious objection that they could do that, but he's saying, you know, once you're mentioning the concept of an Eruv Tchumen, there's no reason to have as many as five sukkahs. In principle, you could get away with fewer. Tosfos, by the way, gets into a long, interesting discussion over here of the point. When we say that you're only allowed to walk 2,000 amas on Shabbos, 4,000 if you have an Eruv Tchumen, then really it's more than that, because that's only if you're walking in one of the cardinal directions. If you're walking, for example, northeast or southwest or what have you, then you have a diagonal to consider. Then you have more, because the diagonal is longer. So then you have up to an extra 800 amas or so that you could walk.
Give you extra amas.
If you have, let's say, for example, so you're in this city for Shabbos, so if you're walking east from the city or west or whatever, then yes, you have exactly 2,000 amas. But if you're walking on a diagonal from the city, northeast or southwest or in any corner, then you have till the corner of that surrounding square, which is going to be a lot bigger. You may have as much as an extra 800 amas or so, Tosfos points out. And Tosfos points out that that's also negeya as far as when we talk about that a person carries something 4 amas on Shabbos, he's chayev. Tosfos points out that Amam also brings this halacha. Really, a person is only going to be chayev only if he carries about 5.6 amas, because that's the diagonal of 4 amas. Anyway. So that also factors into this over here, that in other words, again, that means that the distance can be covered with fewer sukkahs, because, you know, not necessarily is it going exactly due east or due west or whatever of your shalim. Okay, the Gemara says, Kaman oz lahodatanya, who, according to which, so we have three opinions over here. We have, again, Reb Meir that says that there was 12 mil and 10 sukkahs. We have Reb Yehuda says 10 mil and 9 sukkahs. We have Reb Yosi saying that it was 10 mil, but there were only 5 sukkahs. So now, Kaman Ozla Hodetanya, according to which of these Tanoim does it go? This that it says in a Braiso, actually, we said in the Mishnah, Chutz Me'achlan Shebehen Shalei Giyeh Imelatzuk, that the last one didn't accompany him all the way, Ela Omen Meroch Beroyas Maisev, he would stand far away and watch what the guy is doing with the Sarla Zazel. Kaman Kedameir, necessarily, that's like Kedameir, because according to Reb Yehuda or according to Reb Yosi, they could in fact walk with him all the way to the cliff, because it's within, it's either right next to the cliff or it's only a Tum Shabbos away. Okay, we said in the Mishnah, I'll call sukkah v'sukkah omen leha remozin v'arimayim, and every sukkah they would offer him food and water, tonen. Now we learned in a blaise, ma'olam lo hutzruch adam l'kach. Nobody actually ever needed that. We learned yesterday when the questions they asked Rabbi Eliezer, that we learned that Rabbi Eliezer again gave them, when they asked him what happens if the guy becomes sick and he substitutes somebody else, and he gave them kind of an evasive answer, and Rashi explains, because the guy is always a very healthy fellow, so it never happens that he's so weak from this walk on Yom Kippur that he actually needs the food and water. The Chizkuni says they would pick somebody who they knew with Ruach Kodesh or with astrology or whatever was going to die the next year. Fine, but right now he's still a fairly healthy fellow. No. So Ella, but the reason why they would offer him the food, She'ein Adomim, Misha Yesh Le'pas V'Salai, L'Misha'ein Le'pas V'Salai. You can't compare somebody who has bread in his basket to somebody who doesn't. In other words, the very fact that there's food available makes it that itself takes away some of his hunger. Marsha brings from Yerushalmi that says a similar lashon. The Yetzer Hara only has a taiva for something that's also to you. So if they tell him, here, you can have food, that alone weakens the Yetzer Hara, because then the Yetzer Hara is not going to get him to eat it. Hey, I have a chance to get him to do something that's also, because in fact it's mutter. Then we said, so further on in the Mishnah, it talks about what they did with the red strip of wool, where we said they half of it went on the horns of the goat, and half of it went on the rock. So the Gemara says, Tan Rabba, Barishayna hayu koshin loshen shel zahoris al pesach ulam mebachutz. Originally, they would tie this red ribbon on the outside of the door of the ulam. Hilbin, and if it turned white, which showed that Hashem had forgiven the Jewish people's Averis, Marsha explains over here at some length that red represents Averis. We talked about yesterday, we learned how the Pasuk says Hashem's Shechinah is with us even in our Tuma, and we had the Min over there who quoted and said you're like a Nidah, you're separated from Hashem, and no, and the Shechinah is still with us. So the point is, a Nidah, so therefore the blood of Nidah, Taka, represents Tuma with her personally on a national level, and it goes all the way back to the Chet Eitz Hadas, when one of the punishments that Chava was punished with was Dam Nida. So therefore, so now when the red turns white, then it shows that Hashem has wiped away and forgiven the Averis. So Hilbin, if it turned white, Ho Yismechen, then everybody was happy. Loy Hilbin, if it didn't turn white, Ho Yat Savin and Mespajin, then everybody was sad and embarrassed because they see that obviously Hashem has not forgiven our Averis. So therefore, that's no good. Yom Kippur is for to Yom Tov. His skin or shiyu kosher. We learned earlier in the Masechta, in fact, that in Shimon Atzadik's times, it always turned white, and after that, not necessarily. So his skin or shiyu kosher nesar pesach olam b'fnim. So instead, the Chachamim made a takana that they should tie it on the inside of the door of the olam, so that way, at least, it's not visible to everybody. But Vadayin Hoyim it sits in Vadayin. Still, people would peek inside to look. Hilbin how you smech him, like Hilbin how you at save him. And still, if it turned white, they would be happy. And if not, they'd be upset and how you at save him a spaisin. They'd be sad and embarrassed. His skinushi or kosher noise says chetzi basela, the chetzi ben kind of shosurda mashalayach. So therefore, instead, they made the takana that the guy should take it with him to the cliff and tie half of it to the head of the Sar Lazazel and half of it to a rock. And that way, if it doesn't turn white, the only one who sees that is he. And that way, everybody else doesn't have to be upset that Hashem hadn't forgiven their Averis. So there was a rock over there on top of a cliff. There were going to be plenty of rocks. So he picked one particular rock. The Gemara tied to the rock. The Gemara actually explains the point is, you don't want him to tie it only to the head of the goat, because what might happen is, as the goat is falling, it's going to kind of tuck its head between its legs. So then you might not be able to see the strip. On the other hand, you don't want to tie it only to the rock, because the Gemara says what might happen is, it might turn white before he even pushes it off the cliff. And the guy is going to be so excited and so happy about that, he's going to forget to push it off the cliff. So therefore, so they made the takana that you do it this way, and that way he'll remember to do his job. And that way, if it does turn white, then he'll be able to see it, because he'll be able to see, even if you can't see the animal's head, you'll be able to see the one that's tied to the rock. But this way, the point is, only he sees it. So if it doesn't turn white, then only he is upset about it, and everybody else doesn't have to see it. I guess they could ask him. I don't know whether he'd tell. I don't know. Anyway, Marsha goes on to mention over here that also all of this is connected with the Sur Lazazel, because like we talked about yesterday, the Sur represents Esav, and so it represents that Esav, the Koyach HaTurma, takes away all the Averis, and they get thrown down the mountain and then destroyed, and Hashem forgives all the Jewish people's Averis. The Gemara continues. Amr of Nochem bar Napach or Papa Mishum Rabbi Lazar Akaper Barishona Hoyu Koshen Loshen Shal Zahoris Al Pesach Olam Mifnim. So originally, then they would tie this red strip of wool to the inside of the door of the Olam. Even she gia sur la midbar, and actually it didn't even have to be till they pushed it off the cliff. As soon as the sur would reach the desert, Hoyu Malbin, then it would turn white. The Yodin Shanasa Mitzvah, and at that point, they know that the mitzvah has been accomplished. Shanema, now why is it turning white? A simon of Hashem forgiving. Shanema, as the Pasuk says, Yu Chateichim Kashonim, Hashem says, even if you are Averis or like scarlet wool, dyed red, Kashelig Yalbinu, they'll turn white as snow. So therefore, yeah, turning white is a simon that Hashem has forgiven their Averis. So the Gemara continues, Tanya. Now, we learn in a braisa where the Pasuk says that he's taking it to Eretz Gzeira. So what does the word Gzeira mean? Ein Gzeira el chatucha. The word Gzeira means cut off, in the sense it has to be a cliff. It can't be like a gentle slope. It has to be a cliff that drops off sharply. Davar Achag ain't Gzera, Ella Davar Amis Gazer V'Yodin. Another meaning of Gzera is it means something that rips it apart as it goes down. Like we said, he throws down the sir and it gets ripped apart as it's falling. So it has to be a jagged, not just a cliff, but one full of jagged rocks. Davar Achag Gzera, another meaning of the word Gzera is Shema Toma Maisa Tohu. You're going to say this whole thing is for no purpose. What kind of a kapara can you get out of throwing a goat off a cliff? So Gzera. So therefore, Talmud Loma Ani Hashem. Therefore, the pasuk says, "I am Hashem," meaning Ani Hashem Gzartiv. I Hashem made this Gzera. Ve'im l'chol reshus lahara behem. You have no permission to start asking, to think and question it, because you have to realize this is what the Eibush decided. That's a chayk. Yeah. Now Maharsha points out it doesn't actually say Ani Hashem in connection with the parasha of Yom Kippur. It says Ani Hashem only later on in parashas Achrei Mos before it starts talking the Arayas. But it says over there Ushmarta Meschukosai, and it finishes off Ani Hashem. Since the avodah of Yom Kippur is called a chukah, also Devahos Alachem L'chukas Olam. So therefore, that means there's a connection between them. Hashem is saying there's an entire chukah of the details of the avodah of Yom Kippur, and later on Hashem is saying all my chukim, including that one, Ani Hashem, and don't start second guessing. So the Gemara continues. Turn it up on it. Azazel. Why is this place called Azazel? Sheyehe az v'koshen. It has to be very strong and harsh. It has to be a very sharp, like we said, a very sharp, hard cliff. Yochel b'yishuv. You would think it could be even in a settled area. No, Talmud Lomar b'midbar. The pasuk says that he has to take it to the midbar. Uminayin shematzuk. How do we know it has to be an actual cliff? In other words, as v'kosher would just mean it has to be hard ground, hard rocky ground. How do we know it has to be an actual cliff? Talmud Lomar gzera, because like we said before, the word gzera means cut off. Tonet v'Rabbi Shmuel azazel. Another reason why it's called azazel shemachaper al avoin uza v'azoil. It's machaper for the. Did I skip? No. Oh, you're right. Talmud Lomar gzera. You're right. I did. Tanya idach azazel kosher. Thank you. Tanya idach azazel kosher shebaharim. The word azazel means the harshest and the sharpest of mountains. Because the word el means strong. B'chein ha'omer ves elei ha'aretz lokach. As we find a pasuk that it says Nebuchadnezzar took the strong people of the land. So we see that the word el means strong. In fact, as a name of Hashem, it means Hashem who has the ultimate strength. So therefore, so here we're saying as in other words, we're saying it means harsh and strong. Tonet v'Rabbi Shmuel azazel shemachaper alavon uzav azazel. It's also called azazel because it's machaper for the avera of Uza and Azazel. So Rashi describes these are malachim that came down to earth in the times of Nama, the sister of Tuval Kayin. So you have in Parshas Bereishis, you have the sons, you have the children of Lamech, Yovel, Yuval, and Tuval Kayin, all the great inventors. V'achos Tuval Kayin Nama. Then the malachim came down at that point. Who were named Uza and Azoil. Elsewhere in the Medrash calls him Shamchazoy and Azazel, and Shamchazoy and Azoil, rather. The Medrash explained that these Malachim said to Hashem, look how badly people are acting. We told you so. We told you by Ma'aseh Bereishis, don't bother creating human beings because they're going to be terrible. They're going to be terrible creatures. So Hashem says, look, you know, I gave them a Yetzahara. What do you want from them? So they said, Yetzahara, you send us down to earth. We'll show you how a person should act on earth. So Hashem says, fine, go ahead. They went down to earth. They became even worse than the people. They're the Bnei HaLikim. When it says at the end of Parshas Bereishis that Bnei HaLikim saw Bnei Sa'adam and they started having Tivus for them and so on and so forth. Those were these Malachim and their descendants who had come down to the world. So now we're saying the goat, the Sur LaAzazel, is Mechaper for the Averis that those Malachim and their descendants and people like them did. In other words, it's Mechaper even for serious Averis like Arias as they were involved. So that's another reason why it's called Azazel, Meloshen Uza and Azor. Okay, Tonan Abanan Es Mishpatai Tasu. The pasuk says you should keep my chuk. You should keep my mishpatim. What are mishpatim? Dvarim sheu molel nechtevu dinu sheyichtevu. These are mitzvahs where even if they hadn't been written, it would be only logical that they should be written. What we usually think of as mishpatim, dinim mominus, for example. Elohein, or actually not even. Elohein abedizarda begilarayus v'shvichas damim v'gezol birkas Hashem. All of those are very logical mitzvahs. When the pasuk continues, should keep my chukim. That means dvarim shas satan va'akumaz and the goyim meshivin aleim. These are things that the satan and the goyim argue against. Ve'elohein achilas chazir ulavishas shatnez v'chalitzas yivama. Why should you have to do chalitza? V'taras mitzora, the whole ritual of purifying the mitzora. V'sora mishaleach upor adroma. So all of those, Marsha points out, in fact, each of these things has almost like a contradiction in and of itself. For example, you're not allowed to eat chazir. The Gemara tells us in Poland that there's a kind of fish that tastes like chazir. So then, so in that case, then why should Hashem asir chazir tell us? Obviously, Hashem has no objection to the taste of it. If you can eat another thing, that's perfectly mutter. And with each of these other things, we can find something inconsistent within itself. Yibum, you have that usually you're not allowed to marry your brother's wife. It's an isur kares. Here, the Torah is telling you yibum, and that's telling you instead of yibum, you have chalitza. What's the logic? That because of that, she becomes also to you again. And the same thing with each of these other ones, there seems to be something inconsistent within the mitzvah itself. V'shem atoma ma'isa toyuhen, you might say, Taka, there are nothing, they're not for any purpose. No, tamadayma, ani Hashem chakaktim, I Hashem have declared these mitzvahs, ein l'chodeshus l'harabahem, you have no permission to second guess them. And ultimately, we know that even the Mishpatim we keep ultimately because Hashem said so. We may have whatever reasons we can find for them, whatever reasons we can understand for at the end of the day, we keep them because the Eved said so. Yom Yom Mashiach HaGola, Chof Beis Kislev. In every... Excuse me. Just give us a minute or two, please. If in earlier periods time was something that never returns, you lose a moment, you never get it back. All the more so in our times of Ikvah Siddur Mashiach, every moment is very, very precious. You can fill it up and accomplish tremendous things that produce Paris and Paris till the end of the world and Olam Malosh and Helam, that we can do things that will bring about the end of that Helam once and for all. Continuing on the halachas of davening on Shabbos, and by the way, we talked about yesterday, we said that you say Shema Yisrael and Kedusha of Musaf, there's actually a story behind it. At one point, it's brought in Shuvas HaGaonim. At one point, one of the Persian emperors made a gzera that they're not allowed to say Shema in Shul, and they actually had soldiers trying to prevent them from doing that. So therefore, they couldn't say it in Shachos, it was too dangerous. So they moved it to Musaf, and instead of saying the whole Shema, they just put it in Kedusha over there at the beginning, the first pasuk Shema Yisrael, and the last words, Ani Hashem Elokeichem. Eventually, the story goes on that this Persian emperor was killed by a snake or a crocodile or something, came into his palace and ate him up. So and the gzeira was bottled. So in commemoration of that Hashem saved us b'derech nes for all time, the Chachamim left that in Kedusha, and that's how we have it. That's why we have it in Shabbos Kedusha Ad Hayom Hazeh. That's why we have Shema. Why do we have Shema Yisrael on Ani Hashem Elokeichem in the middle of Kedusha of Shabbos? Why is it Kedusha of Shabbos to Musaf like any other Kedusha you just have? Kodesh, 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 and Baruch and Yimlet. That's why, because at first they put it in, because that was the only time they could say Shema safely without the soldiers getting them, and afterwards they kept it in there as a zecher of this nest.